Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for... I think we're going to start the formal proceedings now. So I'll be very brief. I'm Gerard Henderson, the Executive Director of the Sydney Institute, and many thanks to our corporate supporters and associate members for coming along tonight, and special thanks to those who are hosting corporate tables who have agreed to take a couple of extra guests on their table tonight so that the Institute can provide as many places as possible. As is quite evident, it's been a very popular event tonight. Now, before handing over to Nick Johnson, who will be the MC for tonight's dinner, I'd like to make a few brief comments, with the emphasis on brief. As many of you know, the Sydney Institute's annual dinner lecture is a private dinner followed by a public address followed by the end of the private dinner. The media is welcome to film the Prime Minister's address, but the remainder of the night is a private function. It would be appreciated if camera crew and photographers did not walk among the tables. I'm sure you will cooperate. Thanks to Australia Post for again sponsoring this function. It's always great to work with my friend Stephen Walter on the sponsorship, and I'd like to formally welcome Australia Post Chairman David Mortimer and Barbara Mortimer and Australia Post Managing Director Graham John and Diane John, who are seated on the main table here. Now, this year again, Australia Post has provided a guest to a present to all of the guests here, and this year for all guests there's a set of On Your Tables The Less We Forget stamps, which were launched in Melbourne yesterday by the Chief of the Defence Force. In the lead up to Anzac Day, these stamps reflect the contribution of those who served, their loved ones, and those who remember them today. And it's a great collection and a suitable reminder of tonight's dinner. So once again, many thanks to Australia Post. And thanks also to George Mortimer of Energy Australia for making possible the audio-visual coverage of the Prime Minister's address for all of us here tonight. And thanks also to Vintage Blue Wines for their assistance in providing tonight's wines, and to Coca-Cola Amatil, who provided the soft drinks. Thanks to all of them. And now it's over to Nick Johnson, Chairman of the Sydney Institute and Chief Executive of Barclays Capital, who will be tonight's MC. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Gerard. It's great. All of a sudden, it got quiet in here. You may have heard me earlier begging you to sit down. But all of a sudden, this is great. Look, welcome everyone to the 2008 annual dinner of the Sydney Institute. On behalf of my fellow directors of the Institute, I wish also to extend a special welcome to our guest speaker, the Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Many of you will be familiar with the format of tonight's proceedings. We'll immediately serve entree, followed by the main course. Around 9:10 p.m, I will invite Carol Schwartz to introduce Kevin Rudd. Carol is a fellow member of the Sydney Institute Board and is Melbourne-based. Kevin Rudd's talk will conclude around 9:45. I should note that, as with past dinners of this scale, it's not practical for the Prime Minister to take questions after his address. Geraldine Duke, who is well known to all of you, will thank our speaker at the conclusion of the lecture. Dessert will follow and dinner will formally conclude at 10:30 sharp, although you're of course welcome to stay on for conversation. As in previous dinners, you're welcome and indeed encouraged to move around the room between courses. Dinner for nearly 900 people like this is no easy logistical feat. The problems are never ending, rather like putting an octopus into a bucket. Just when you think it's all done, one more arm flops over the side. And in that context, the board would like to thank the Sydney Institute staff who've organised tonight's event, specifically Deputy Director Anne Henderson and Alita Mathias, with able support from Vibrian Nuthu, Raffi Gold, Anya Tuchansky, and of course the board's thanks to all the Institute's corporate supporters and associate members, many of whom are here tonight. And if you aren't a supporter or a member and want to join, please just ask me or any of the board members. Board members here tonight include, are Rob Ferguson, former name, Peter Drysdale, Meredith Helicar, Lynn Ralph, Carol Schwartz, and Warwick Smith. To recap, the Sydney Institute is a public affairs forum which conducts around 60 policy forums each year. Papers from these forums, and including tonight's lecture, are published in the Institute's publication, The Sydney Papers, and are available as podcasts. The Institute also publishes the Sydney Institute quarterly and conducts over a dozen private dinners each year for our corporate supporters, plus at least three dinners for younger representatives of our supporters. Now, please enjoy the evening. I look forward to Kevin Ludd delivering the lecture around 9:10. Thank you. Exactly, a bell from the original HMAS Sydney. So it was the one that was decommissioned in 1928. So in that sense, it's quite topical at the moment. But look, we have to move tonight's agenda forward. And I would just say that Sky News is going to be filming the address. So if you see a lot of TV cameras, don't be surprised. I'm going to hand over to Carol Schwartz. Carol plays an important role for the Sydney Institute. She's one of our Melbourne-based directors, as well as being a very successful business person in her own right. And tonight, I'll ask Carol to introduce Kevin Rudd. Carol Schwartz.
Thanks, Nick. You did very well in controlling the crowd then. That was fantastic. Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I wanted to tell you that in 2002, I travelled to the US as a delegate to a conference in Washington. And that year, we were lucky enough to have amazing access to some very senior people in the White House administration. At each one of the briefings, we attended with Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, Colin Powell, amongst others. There would be one person who would consistently ask some of the most insightful and compelling questions. "Who is that guy?" I asked one of my colleagues. "He always asks the really smart, tough questions." "That's Kevin Rudd, the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs," I was told. I was to meet Kevin later in the trip, albeit briefly, and have been fortunate enough to get to know him in the last few years in a number of different contexts. The intellectual rigour, tenacity, discipline, quiet confidence, spontaneity and quirky sense of humour have all revealed themselves over the years and have been the attributes which I believe have propelled him to the levels of popularity he has been able to achieve and ultimately to the Prime Ministership of this country. As this audience well knows, Kevin Rudd was elected to Parliament as the Member for Griffith in October 1998. He has been a long-term friend of the Sydney Institute and addressed the Institute in 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006, and most recently in July last year. Kevin Rudd promised that he would return to the Sydney Institute if he was elected Prime Minister, and here he is. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very great pleasure to introduce the Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd.
Thanks very much, Carol. You said I had a quirky sense of humour. That's what I thought I was doing when I did that for President of a democracy not far from our own. But some people didn't share the joke. This is the biggest crowd I've seen since the Great Hall of the People. So, thank you, Nick Johnson, by the way, for introducing me as Mr. Kevin Ludd. Don't worry about it, mate. I didn't take it personally. I didn't even notice it. I just wrote it down. But, mate, it's a big advance from where I've just been, because when many of my Chinese friends have introduced me in English, I'm invariably introduced as either Mr. Rude, and some would agree with that, or Mr. Lewd, and I won't go there. Thanks also to Gerard and Anne for inviting me to address the Sydney Institute. As Carol has just said, this is the sixth occasion, which says that Gerard and Anne, and Gerard in particular, obviously is a sucker for punishment, or else with a big taste for stigmata, to have me back yet again. My staff calculated this as I came here tonight, Gerard. I have uttered some 35,000 words to the Sydney Institute. I've stood before Sydney Institute audiences for a total of 7 hours, and I've taken a truckload of questions. But when the staff went to your website to find what inevitably you would think would be the natural DVD entitled The Best of Rudd, they couldn't find a thing. Not even a little one. Not even that rip tickler one I gave way back when, which was fresh insights into the future of the non-farm deflator. I didn't really. So I thought about it, though. Speaking of Gerard, he was, as I came in here this evening, repeated the well-worn phrase of the last several days, which is with myself as Prime Minister from Queensland and Wayne Swan, who's here tonight as Treasurer, also from Queensland, and our Governor-General-elect, Quentin Bryce from Queensland. She will make a fantastic Governor-General. That there's some new secret society, the pineapple conspiracy. Can I just say to this audience here in Sydney tonight that this is absolutely without foundation. And the fact that Gerard has received and accepted a grant from the Rudd government's Regional Partnerships Program to rename the Sydney Institute the Brisbane Institute should not be confused. In fact, the truth is I love travelling to Australia's greatest city, and it's great to come to Sydney as well. That was a staff suggestion line, so if any of you took offence, and I'm looking at the Sydney Daily Telegraph here, it was their fault, not mine. But seriously, Gerard, thanks for the invitation to address the annual dinner of the Sydney Institute. Since 1989, the Institute has been a platform for public policy debate on Australia's future. The nation should always embrace such debate with genuine intellectual passion and with genuine intellectual rigour. Great challenges lie ahead of us as a nation, now more than ever. We need a real debate which transcends the old battle lines of the left and the right of Australian politics. The global context in which this debate now occurs has moved a long, long way over the last 20 years. Market-based economic solutions have now been embraced across much of the former and continuing communist worlds. At the same time, we've seen a parallel recognition in the capitalist West that Adam Smith's invisible hand does not represent the solution to every economic problem. And in recent times, this has been demonstrated by the current debate on the proper regulation of global financial markets. The real terrain for productive public policy debate resides in a clear recognition of how markets should be regulated to ensure equitable competition, how to identify where markets fail, what represents the proper scope of the provision of public goods such as education, health, a humane safety net, and global environmental sustainability, and how do we build this nation's competitive strengths in an increasingly competitive global economy. Each of these invites a rich political and policy debate in themselves. These are the core debates at the progressive reforming centre of contemporary Australian politics. And these are very much the debates that the government intends to advance. The purpose of my remarks tonight is to provide a broad outline of the government's vision for the nation's future, the start that we have made in advancing that vision, and the role we hope the upcoming National Summit, the 2020 Summit, can play in taking that vision forward into the long-term future. The new Australian government is committed to building a modern, competitive Australia capable of meeting the challenges of the 21st century to secure the nation's future as well as a future for our working families. Our agenda for achieving this is shaped by the core values for which we stand,
values of security, of liberty, of opportunity, of creativity, values of equity, of family, of community, of solidarity, of sustainability, and an underlying fundamental value of an irreducible human dignity. These values very much shape the government's vision for Australia's future. We are committed to a secure Australia, strong at home and fully engaged abroad through what I have described elsewhere as a creative middle power diplomacy. We are committed to building a robust economy through a combination of responsible economic management and a program to enhance Australia's global economic competitiveness. We are committed to opportunity for all Australians, not just for some, through a vision for Australia to develop the best educated, best trained, best skilled workforce in the world. We are committed to a creative Australia, where imagination and creativity drive our efforts in the arts, sciences, and the development of a pervasive national culture of innovation and enterprise. We're committed to the advancement of a fair go for all Australians through education, health, and the rules that govern the workplace. We believe that as a Labor government, it's our responsibility to challenge the limitations placed on people's potential, including the potential of Indigenous Australians, by the circumstances that people inherit. We're committed to the protection of the family by advancing family-friendly workplaces and better work-life balance. We're committed to the concept of opportunity for communities. Communities not as a collection of disconnected individuals, but as a place where people are bound by common core values and a common sense of responsibility to one another. We're committed also to a principle of social solidarity that extends beyond private philanthropy to a public responsibility to protect the most vulnerable through a humane safety net for all Australians. And we're also committed to the great public good of our age, the protection of what's called the global commons, and that is the planet itself, both for all of us who share that planet today and for those who come after us. And finally, we are committed to fundamental human dignity through a judicial system that provides for the proper protection of the basic human rights of all. Part of our vision is to give every opportunity to individuals to provide for their own future by rewarding hard work, enterprise, and success. And part of our vision is to engender a sense also of social responsibility. In fact, our vision incorporates quite consciously a combination of private markets and public goods, or what I've already called tonight a new tradition of the reforming centre of Australian politics. This also is where I believe the modern Australia of the 21st century wants to go. For many years, it's been unfashionable to talk of a vision for the nation's future. In fact, some have argued that the framing of such a vision is ideologically unsustainable because nations simply evolve as a consequence of the market forces that shape them. I disagree, because I believe a small country occupying a vast continent such as this, in a region as wildly disparate as our own, has no option other than to plan for its future. As it is written elsewhere, without a vision, the people perish. I believe that as a nation we need to come together around clear long-term goals for Australia, the Australia of 2020 and beyond. These objectives should be ambitious. Excessive caution and a fear of failure should not hold us back. In fact, it's been the absence of such agreed national goals over the last decade that has seen us waste much of the great dividend that has flowed to Australia through our record terms of trade. How different would it be now if we had invested the estimated $398 billion in beyond parameter growth in public revenues in the period since 2002 in funding a total education revolution? How different would it be? But instead of investing in the future against concrete, realisable goals, the revenue was consigned by and large to consumption, both public and private. Opportunities squandered rather than opportunities seized. In the century ahead, it's not unreasonable for Australia to aspire to be the best place on earth to live, to gain an education, to work, and to raise a family. A nation with first-rate business and employment opportunities, powered by the world's most educated, most skilled and best trained workforce. A nation where we strive for the highest public health standards in the world. A nation where we care for the vulnerable and where we include the outcast. a dynamic, vibrant culture incorporating the best of our many immigrant cultures within the best traditions of European civilization that we have inherited, turbocharged with the best understanding across the collective West of the languages and cultures of the high civilizations of Asia in whose regions we exist. In a nation with a livable climate, a clean environment, and an extraordinary, well-protected natural beauty. We can also be a nation with a sense of wider purpose, for not a nation turned in on itself and occupied only with its own future, but, for example, a nation that is a great force for good in the world, a nation that contributes to peace and prosperity in our region and beyond. A nation whose belief in the fair go extends beyond the continental shelf. A multicultural, multilingual nation standing on the doorstep of the fastest growth region on the planet. And a nation that fully comprehends the meeting place that now exists between East and West as the Asia-Pacific century begins to unfold. But the kind of nation we are in 2020 will only be what we plan for and what we choose together to build together. And that, in large part, is why in a few days' time we are convening a national 2020 summit in the nation's parliament in Canberra. To unleash the national imagination beyond the ranks of politics and the public service, and to help fashion a new national consensus around a common vision for the nation, with common goals for us to aim for within that vision. We can either drift into the future, or we can take hold of the future with our own hands to shape the future and to seize the day. We've been in office for a little more than 4 months now, and we've been making some progress towards our vision for a modern Australia. Within a few minutes of taking office, the government signed the instruments to the Kyoto Protocol, and we are now active participants in the Bali Roadmap on climate change. On the first sitting day of our Parliament, I extended an apology to the stolen generations of Indigenous Australians. And we've begun a policy program of closing the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous life opportunities in Australia. The government has also embraced a comprehensive productivity agenda based on a new program of microeconomic reform, beginning with an education revolution, the reform of the nation's infrastructure, including the great transformational technology platform that high-speed broadband represents for the 21st century, and by boosting workforce participation. The government has commenced also a new era in Commonwealth-state relations through the COAG reform process, to reform the Federation, to end the blame game, to remove the regulatory burdens on business, and to rebuild our nation's health system. Also, the government has concluded an historic agreement with the state and territory governments of Australia to establish, for the first time, a single national authority to manage Australia's major inland river system, the Murray-Darling, whose future is threatened by the impact of overuse and climate change. Government has also commissioned its first white paper on homelessness and is looking at how to invest in compassionate, market-based solutions which deal with this important social policy challenge. Internationally, the government has been active in establishing the three pillars of our relationship and engagement with the world: a strong alliance with the United States, engagement with the United Nations, including the announcement of our candidature for the UN Security Council after a 25-year absence, and a strong commitment to our own immediate region, including a determination to tackle the challenges of underdevelopment here in the Pacific Island states through our new proposal for Pacific Partnerships for Development. And, most recently, the government has also advanced the cause of greater gender equality by appointing the first female Governor-General in 107 years. Through these actions, we have made progress in our first 4 months. It is a start, but it is only a start. And as we move towards a bolder, more ambitious program for the future, we are also conscious of the challenges we face in implementing that program, including the storm clouds that continue to gather across the global economy. The global economic context has clearly become more complicated since we took office. The global economic outlook has sharply deteriorated with a double warning of lower growth and higher inflation. Last week, the International Monetary Fund estimated a 25% chance of a worldwide economic downturn. The fund has lowered its global growth forecasts to 3.7% this year from a 4.1% prediction in January. It anticipates a mild recession in the United States and slower growth in Europe and Japan. It also noted that growth would slow in the emerging Asian economies from 7.4% in 2007 to 6.2% this year as a result of further global financial market turbulence and reduced demand for Asian imports. Recent developments in financial markets also affect the financial security of Australia's working families because of its impact on the real economy and the availability of credit for lending. As financial markets become more global, so too must proper regulation, supervision and transparency become more global. But without crushing the capacity of markets themselves to respond flexibly to new opportunities in the future. Recently, I've spoken at length about these challenges with policy leaders, financial decision makers and regulators in the United States, the United Kingdom, the wider European Union and China, including the head of the IMF. I emphasise Australia's willingness to contribute to what must be a global response by our respective national regulators to what is truly a global financial crisis. The Reserve Bank of Australia is actively contributing to the work of the Financial Stability Forum. We're also taking action at home. The government's approach involves several elements, including monitoring liquidity needs internationally and through the RBA participating where appropriate in coordinated central bank action. We'll continue to monitor the Australian financial system in light of the current turbulence to ensure that it remains efficient, flexible, and competitive. Beyond these immediate measures concerning financial market stability, it is now more critical than ever that we deal with declining global economic confidence by bringing about a successful conclusion to the Doha round of free trade negotiations. This is why the government is redoubling its efforts in Geneva, and why Doha was a prominent feature of my discussions recently with political leaders in Washington, Brussels and London. In summary, the global economic context in which the new government is framing its long-term reform strategy, as well as the upcoming budget, is the most challenging Australia has faced since the Asian financial crisis of 1997 and arguably since the global recession of the early 1990s. The cornerstone of the government's economic strategy, therefore, is responsible economic management, maintaining our anti-inflation strategy based on producing a significant budget surplus, while at the same time advancing a comprehensive agenda of microeconomic reform aimed at boosting long-term productivity growth. Looking forward to the decade ahead, Australia must be mindful of both the immediate challenges to the global economy, as well as the unfolding mega-challenges that are radically transforming the world in which Australia must now carve out its future. We know that on current trends, the demography of our planet will change significantly over the next 12 years. By 2020, the world's population will have grown by another 1 billion people to 7.6 billion. By 2020, a representative group of 100 global citizens would include 56 Asians, including 19 Chinese and 17 Indians, 16 Africans, 4 from the United States, 5 Western Europeans, and not a single Australian, in relatively speaking. We'll still make a large noise. In 2020, the world's 5 largest cities by population will be Seoul, Sao Paulo, Bombay, Jakarta, and Karachi, all cities in emerging economies. We also know that on current projections, the global balance of economic power will shift significantly over the next 12 years. By 2020, the world economy is expected to be about 80% larger than it is today. The average per capita income will be roughly 50% higher. By 2020, Asia will have grown to 43% of the world GDP, and Asia's economy will be larger than that of the United States and Europe combined. Alongside the shift in economic power, there are likely to be parallel shifts in the global strategic balance of power. China's defence spending is forecast to rise to $150 billion per year, according to the US National Intelligence Council, making it second only to the United States. By 2020, the demands on the world's energy resources will have increased dramatically by nearly 50%. China alone will seek to increase its energy consumption by about 150% by 2020 to maintain a steady rate of growth.
Even though the world's fossil fuel reserves are being depleted at a rapid rate, absent policy change, alternative energy will still account for only a small fraction of overall energy consumption by 2020. As our use of fossil fuels increases, so will its observable effects on the natural environment that sustains us all. Sea levels will rise, temperatures will increase, and there will be more extreme weather events. Climate change means variable water availability, more frequent droughts, floods and bushfires, altered distribution of pests and weeds, and the move of tropical diseases into what are currently categorised as temperate zones. Australia too will have changed significantly by 2020. Our annual output on current Treasury projections will have risen $400 billion to $1.4 trillion US. GDP per capita will have risen by about 11,000 to over 60,000. Australia's population by 2020 is expected to grow to over 25 million, while the median age of our population will increase from 36 to 40 years. Our population of Australians over 85 will have doubled from 300,000 to 600,000 by 2020, with profound implications for national healthcare expenditures. The number of households in Australia will grow by an additional 3 million in the next 15 years, but the average size of those households will likely continue to decline. By 2020, the average Australian household will contain just 2.2 people. If current trends continue by 2020, diabetes will be the leading cause of disease for men and the second leading cause of disease for women. Dementia, anxiety and depression will feature in the leading four health challenges for both men and women. On a three-decade projection, the fastest escalation in costs in health expenditure will be incurred by diabetes at 400%, followed by neurological disorders at 280%. These statistics give us just a snapshot of the challenges we confront in the years ahead. And this gives us some indication of the depth and breadth of the global and national challenges Australia faces in planning for the decade which lies ahead of us. In planning ahead, the most powerful force in our nation is not the federal government's capacity to make laws or implement programs from on high. The government cannot on its own legislate productivity, competitiveness, business innovation, or healthier lifestyles. Our most powerful force is the ideas, talent, and energy of the Australian people themselves. Our greatest potential lies in forging a new partnership between communities, businesses, the various levels of government, and other non-government organisations to work together to tackle the big challenges that lie ahead. Government will provide leadership. Partnership is required. Partnership is essential if leadership is to have effect on the ground. If as a nation we are genuinely practical and empirical in our approach to finding new approaches to tackle old problems, then we can move forward. And many of these new discoveries will dissolve old debates between left and right based on outmoded versions of reality. Witness, for example, the collapse, virtually, of the age-old debate on welfare entitlement on the one hand and individual responsibility on the other. Largely because, through community engagement, we've been taught that mutual responsibility is the best way forward, both for the individual and for the public purse. If we therefore genuinely engage society, and not merely the state, in other words, Australian people and not just Australian governments, then we begin to also identify a new way of doing business for the nation. The Australia 2020 Summit is an important part of this process, recognising that government does not have all the wisdom, and recognising that our political opponents also have a contribution to make, which is why we welcome contributions to the summit from across the political spectrum. It's why we've included distinguished Australians, like former National Party leader Tim Fischer, former Liberal Minister Warwick Smith, who's here with us this evening, as co-chairs of different streams in the summit. I also welcome the participation of the Leader of the Opposition. The 2020 summit is an opportunity for us to rise above partisan politics, and we should create more such opportunities in our national life. The summit will address the long-term challenges confronting Australia's future across 10 critical challenge areas. 1. Future directions for the Australian economy and how we build a competitive economy in a world being transformed by the rise of China and India. 2. The productivity agenda, including education, skills, training, science and innovation. 3. population, sustainability, climate change and water. 4, future directions for rural industries and rural communities. 5, a national long-term health strategy, including challenges of preventative health, workforce planning and how to deal with the ageing of our population. 6, strengthening communities, supporting families and social inclusion. 7, options for the future of Indigenous Australia. 8, towards a creative Australia, the future of the arts, film and design. 9, the future of Australian governance, renewed democracy, a more open government, including the role of the media, the structure of the Federation and the rights and responsibilities of citizens. 10, Australia's future security and prosperity in a rapidly changing region and world. In the lead up to this weekend, we have already conducted local 2020 summits, school 2020 summits, a national youth 2020 summit, and one yesterday with the Jewish community, given the next weekend coincides with the Passover. The local 2020 summits have attracted thousands of attendees. The school summits have been held in more than 500 schools across Australia. Some responses highlighted serious social problems. Many students have commented on their parents' long work hours. And some have some very sobering words for us here this evening. And I'll quote one of them. Give advice to parents. Teach people how to be a mum and a dad. We should help people so they don't have to work so much. Parents need to play with their kids more. Parents need to pay more attention to their children. There's no time for kids. Kids need more time. Unquote. Out of the mouths of babes. On a similar theme, a group of students midway through high school recommended some positive steps. Now, quote again, increase interaction between parents and children through working from home, reducing work hours, a take your children to work day every so often. The employer could be more productive too. The employer could also give out promotions which will help to build up family activities, e.g. tickets to theme parks and sports games. A Victorian student linked modern work demands on future health problems. And I quote again, exercise, no time in the future because we work longer hours. Today, students love new technology, but many show a sophisticated understanding of how technology is contributing to social isolation. Like the primary school kid from Queensland who remarked, and I quote again, people won't have to leave their houses because everything will be able to be completed online and delivered to the door, and this will be very sad. Unquote. They're watching. They're watching very carefully what's going on. And it's sobering. School teachers have done a particularly first-rate job in getting their students to think about how we make Australia an even better place. And I thank them for the work that they have done in the various school summits conducted around the nation. After the completion of these school summits last weekend, Parliament House hosted a National Youth 2020 Summit. 100 young Australian leaders came together to put forward thoughtful and substantive proposals on matters including education, preventative health, mental health, climate change and Australia's place in the world, and some really good ideas in that collection. The Youth Summit came up with 10 key proposals, 30 additional ideas, and the Prime Minister's Department is now reviewing them in more detail. Participants in all these events would confirm that we've had no predetermined agenda for these summits, no predetermined outcomes. There are no right and wrong answers here. It's time for the political class in a country to actually listen to the people. To help focus the discussions this weekend, I'll be asking each of the working group co-chairs to nominate at least one big idea in their area for the future. Second, I'll also ask them to submit at least 3 concrete policy ideas, at least one of which must involve no cost or negligible costs. And that's always the hard one. And third, I'll be asking them to identify at least 3 specific goals for which we as a nation should aim by 2020. The government will sift through the submissions and recommendations from the summit and provide a response to its outcomes by the end of this year, those we can embrace and those we cannot, and the reasons for both. I'll also be taking a proposal onto the summit myself for discussion. My proposal for Australia in the year 2020 is to create universal, high-quality, affordable parent and child centres for all 0 to 5-year-old Australian kids, should their parents so choose to use them. I believe such centres could offer real practical assistance to working families under financial pressure, struggling with the practical challenges of raising very young kids. These parent and child centres will bring together maternal and child health, long day care and preschool into one-stop shops for parents with young kids. The goal of this ambitious proposal would be, if adopted, to offer all parents with 0 to 5-year-olds access to a one-stop shop early childhood centre, which would provide 4 things. Maternal and child health services, such as baby health checks, baby weighing, feeding advice and vaccinations. 2, long day care, including play-based activity for children whose parents are at work or studying. 3, preschool and early learning, including age-appropriate play-based learning provided by a qualified teacher. And 4, play groups and parental support and advice to ensure parents have a place to meet other parents and to get access to advice where their children are playing. This model would require unprecedented partnerships between federal, state and local governments, as well as existing private and community service providers. I understand that. The aim would be to provide most of these new services at low cost to parents. However, some services on offer, such as long day care services, would be fee-based, but with the cost still subsidised by government. Access to these parent and child centres would be universal, but not compulsory, and the quality of service provided would be underpinned by strengthened national quality standards. Some or all of the services offered in these centres could be supplied by the private sector and would be subject to competition between providers, helping to drive quality up and prices down. A single service centre model for all 0 to 5-year-olds would offer great benefits to kids, great benefits to parents, and great benefits to the whole community. It could provide the quality of health and education care services to 0 to 5s, with improvements including better quality care that is underpinned by the strengthened national quality standards, the introduction of more 4-year trained early childhood education professionals for all young children regardless of age, provision of education, health and other supports for children to make sure they're developing properly, both physically and intellectually. These centres could also improve the level of support for parents, providing convenient health, education and care services for working parents, providing age-appropriate services for parents with several kids under 5, and providing opportunities for non-working parents to meet and to develop peer supports and access advice where their kids play. These centres could also improve outcomes for the nation and for the community, making better use of early childhood resources, reducing duplication, which means more money for frontline services, and providing additional support to disadvantaged families to improve the life chances of their children. A little over a century ago, few would have dreamt that today we would have universal and affordable schooling for our children. We've already set ourselves the goal of introducing universal preschool services for all 4-year-olds by 2013. It's a commitment from the government that I lead. We should aim, if we adopt the proposal I'm putting forward, to take the next step and create universal parent and child centres for all children aged 0 to 5 by 2020, if parents choose to so use them. Early childhood reform lies at the intersection of our aspirations for the nation. Lifting long-term productivity and participation through greater investment in education, particularly the early years, a commitment to reducing the cost of living pressures on working families, and a serious effort to reduce the gaps between children born in disadvantaged families and growing up in disadvantaged communities. This proposal builds on the extensive research which has already been done on the critical impact of a child's early nurture, care, and positive engagement with learning on every aspect of that child's later life. This proposal has not been costed at this stage. The proposal has been put forward to be debated on its merits at the upcoming summit. And I look forward to the inputs of my fellow summit participants, both positive and negative. And I promise to be positive about the negatives, on this and other proposals that are put forward over the weekend. To conclude, 12 years from now, another group of Australians will gather to celebrate the Sydney Institute's 2020 annual dinner in Brisbane, marking what will be the Institute's 31st year. Who knows what they will take as their subject? Maybe the low-carbon energy revolution in response to climate change, the rise and rise again of India, new security challenges from a new generation of contagious diseases cross-border, new transformational technologies we haven't even begun to think about, or perhaps the new challenges of interfaith dialogue among the 80% of the world's population who are religious believers but of different faiths. I hope they can look back on the Australia of 12 years ago and say that 2008 was something of a turning point, a time when Australia saw its potential, recognised its strengths and seized the future, a time when we took stock, looked beyond the trenches for a bit and imagined what we as a people might become. A time when we said that we were done with short-term thinking and began substantial planning for the long term. A time when we injected not just new ideas, but also a new approach to policy making. A time when we brought into the policy making process people whose skills and ideas have never been fully embraced before. And I hope the results will be evident in the modern Australia of 2020. A nation whose education revolution has transformed future opportunities for a rising generation of young Australians. A nation with a key role in expanding global markets, in the new productivity and growth drivers of the future, in clean energy technologies, the biosciences, agricultural innovation, given impending shortage in world food, and right across our new service industries. A nation which by 2020 that leads in its response on climate change and has become the envy of the rest of the world. And a nation that has become a great force for good in its region and the world. I thank you.
Someone told me this week that this isn't a socialist government, but that sounds to me like a wonderful catalogue of things done and things to do that any socialist government should be pretty proud of. But anyway, I'm not here to say that. I'm here really to introduce Geraldine Doog to propose a vote of thanks to the Prime Minister. She'll present a small token of our appreciation on behalf of the Sydney Institute, and it's a framed version of the wonderful Australia Post Lest We Forget stamps. So Geraldine, if she's here, she's coming.
Well, thank you, Nick. And, well, I must say, I certainly wouldn't have defined it as socialism, Nick. I would have defined it as redefining aspirational very much. And I suppose I sat there listening and thought to myself, this is a man who is enjoying himself enormously at the moment. It's a man in his prime. We've watched, I think, as someone in a state of flow, that great psychological term, meaning almost energy in equals energy out, someone who enjoys doing what they're doing for the sake of it. And I think, in a way, we've probably been all watching on thinking, well, this is the state of enjoying the work you're doing because it has such a very clear purpose. And I suppose, in a way, you're inviting us, Prime Minister, to join in that much more expansive view of Australia. You've outlined some very big dreams, particularly in the parent-child front. That is a most ambitious aim, very much tying in with the sort of research that shows that, in fact, early childhood is where enormous gains can be made, and I absolutely applaud that extraordinarily bold set of aims. But the notion of being in a state of flow, it doesn't last forever necessarily. There are no guarantees that this wonderful feeling that, it's true. It's one of those, it's a time of grace, and in a sense I feel that we were graced tonight with a wonderful invitation. The absolute rebuttal, it seemed to me, of Maggie Thatcher's there is no such thing as society. I mean, you ultimately said, I fundamentally believe in the notion of society and in Australian society and its possibilities right now. Of course, they do say the secret of vision is not knowing what to do, it's knowing what to do next. And I suppose, in a sense, that is the great challenge to all of us as we sit here tonight, incredibly privileged and blessed and invited by yourself to take up the big challenges. I do hope, as a participant at the summit, I do hope that that's exactly what a lot of us will do and, in effect, be a proxy for millions of other Australians. But I do hope that you continue to enjoy your time as Prime Minister and enjoy bringing us along with you. And may I thank you in that eloquent way you immortalised recently. Prime Minister, we salute you.
And that really is.
No, I thought it gives a sense.
Okay, stamps in a moment, Prime Minister. Look. Thank you, Geraldine. Thank you, everybody. Thank you all for coming. That really is the conclusion of the evening. But there's no rush to leave. Stick around for dessert, coffee, conversation, the whole lot. Great evening. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Geraldine. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.